the future does not exist.
All right, welcome, dear earlobes. Once again, you're here with The Future Does Not Exist, a podcast about remarkable people and remarkable stories and sometimes remarkable places and other things that we can remember. This is me, Damien Leslie, and I'm joined today by...
Marcel van Schoten.
And it's just the two of us today.
Yes.
So there's an empty void next to us, but that doesn't mean that we have nothing to talk about.
No. And we're, if I look at you, it looks like we're outside summertime enjoying the sunshine because he's sitting across me with sunglasses on.
I've got sunglasses on because the sun is belting through this window that we're sitting in. And I'm feeling like proper, like in rock star mode with my yellow shades on and lounging on a couch with a microphone in front of me. But outside, it's still bastard freezing.
Yes, but it is spring, according
to... They tell me spring's around the corner. I imagine it's like, this is what spring should feel like.
Yeah.
But actually sitting here, it's more like what a sun lamp would feel like.
Yeah.
So I might get... you can't get sunburn through glass, but I could feel my head reddening, so to speak, anyway. But besides that, we're here in Leiden once again. It's a beautiful spring morning.
Yes.
There's no cuckoos or anything around, so what we can see. I have noticed that we've got extra plastic crows on the balconies around us.
Do we?
So last time we were here, there was one plastic crow. Essentially, what we look out on is what I would call like a kind of tenement block. And there's one balcony kind of across from us and up. It's on the fourth floor, I think. Mm-hmm. And it has this weird spiral kind of spikes sticking out of the top.
Yeah.
And I presume they're there for decoration. Either that or skewer pigeons.
I think they're connecting to the other things that are there.
Okay. And there was one black crow. There was a plastic black crow, which was obviously there to stop pigeons...
Yeah.
Sitting on that part. There's now three.
Three? I thought it was two.
No, there's three.
All right.
So they're breeding. It's like the world's slowest version of Hitchcock's The Birds, but in plastic.
Yeah, the funny thing is, 2 weeks ago, I was also looking there. And on the one balcony, you had the three fake crows. And above there were three pigeons. Like, we're just going to sit up. Above you. We don't give a shit.
Yeah. I would really enjoy it if the pigeons just sat on the balcony above and just shit on their plastic crows all day.
Or sit on top of the crows. Yeah. That would be even more.
So we'll keep you posted, listeners, on the spread of plastic animals.
Yeah.
It's always interesting.
It's better than the weird, almost kite things.
Yes.
Those are really weird.
Yeah. The kite kestrels,
yeah,
and stuff that they stick on top of office buildings here.
And you're like, what?
I've never seen a bird take any notice of it.
No.
They just sit underneath it and go, oh, flying a kite.
Entertainment.
Yeah, it's quite cool.
Oh.
All right, we're rambling already. But that's good. All right, you're going to kick us off today.
Yeah, I'm going to kick us off. If you're a faithful listener to our podcast, you've noticed that we've moved away from our talking about people and talking more about other stuff. So we decided to return to our back to basic, how to call it, if you want to call it like that, and return to talking about people, because that's one of the things that we sort of started this and don't want to... lost track of.
I think one of the things, at least in the initial conversations that we had before this became a podcast vehicle, was that we've met and have came across so many interesting and unique characters, people.
We did.
And so that we find so much more fascinating than the amount of crap that we're force fed every day is to, this is what an interesting person, celebrity stuff looks like.
It sure does.
Because and even like after years of working within the music industry to one extent or the other, the characters that we kind of imagined were in that world, mm-hmm, are there, but they're not where you think they are.
No.
So most of the interesting people work behind the scenes or like the enigma of like the star that would be really interesting. Usually they're the ones that we kind of go, yeah, they're okay and cool, but yeah. There's something missing when you get actually talking to them as
thing.
And the most interesting ones have been the ones who are slightly more just doing their own thing.
Yeah,
and not interested in the
and the ones that don't really looking forward to stand in the spotlight.
Yes.
And I know one of them that I really admire is a younger guy called Victor. Victor has the for foreign people the unpronounceable name of Hachmann, which is probably the most weirdest sounding name ever. And I know Victor for a long, long time. I know him because I saw an exhibition of his dad in a church in Noordwijk, and I saw him before that, but I'm not really didn't really figure out who it was. He usually was a friend of another guy I know, and so we were introduced. And Victor like, yeah, I make art as well. Like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I know other people that also claim that, and you're like, ah, okay. And he was like, yeah, I'll show you something. And I was like, okay, show me stuff. And he was like, okay. he's sort of fascinated with, I think it's more a Japanese or Asian style kind of creating.
Yes.
Because it's super detailed and it's super, it can be very like small or in a bigger way, but it usually has lots of layers and layers and layers on top of it.
Yeah.
And he also likes the techniques of using, one of the techniques he uses is a riso printer.
Yeah.
And a riso printer is a bit like a very massive copying machine that only has really funky colors, like bright pink or bright green or other bright Japanese feeling colors. And I was actually at his house and he showed me that he had one in the basement. And he found it somewhere online and he started experimenting with it. And a riso printer works really nice. You create it and you create a layer document, and what you do, you print one layer that color and then you print the next layer on top of it, and you decide how many layers you want to create with it. But you have to make sure that it's it works within each other,
yeah,
because the layers go on top of each other. Yeah. So the colors go on top of each other, and you have to make sure that you dry it in between because you don't want to make smudges or make the image like ruin your image. And he managed to sort of master that technique, and he probably does lots of mistakes in the whole process, but he makes so cool stuff.
Yeah. It's almost a kind of screen, like a screen printing. Like electronic technology.
In a way, it's like the
electronic screen is the one I'm thinking
of. Yeah, it's sort of the electronic version of it.
Yeah.
You approach it the same way. You create all the layers or the, like in, with silkscreen, you create the windows.
Yeah.
And you put the paint on top of it. And this paint is like digital. It's powdery. Yeah. And you create it like that. But he creates his, creations. He can also make a silkscreen out of it because it's, the idea is the same thing.
Yes.
And he makes such cool stuff. And I first time I asked him to create something was probably one of the first posters we needed for Sub 71. And I asked him, like, can you make this? And he's like, okay. When do you need it? And like, in a couple of weeks, like, okay, that could be tricky. Like, what? Why? Yeah, now sometimes it takes a while.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, yeah, like a true artist. He's like, yeah. So he disappeared for 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, he came back and I was like, wow.
Yeah.
He created such cool stuff. And every time he created stuff, He was completely oblivious, like most artists, like about costs. He was like, I want to create cool stuff and I don't care how what the cost will be.
Yeah.
So the first poster that he made for Sub was like, if you really calculated it, it was like a euro per poster.
Yeah.
Which was kind of stupid, but yeah. He was like, okay, for once we can do without that. And he was like, oh, okay. Do you want me to make more? Yeah, but we need to make it
more cost effective, please.
Yeah, we make it more like, could you do it like in a digital way? It's like, okay.
Yeah. He's got a really wonderful design sense about his work as well. So most of the stuff I've seen of his actually has been poster work. It's been, am I right? He did the cover for Richard's book, didn't he?
Yeah, also.
So, but he's got a really beautiful sense of graphic design.
Yeah.
Of like watch. And as much as like you said, that the work is extensively layered, it feels like there's something, the heart of what is kind of, you have to go through some layers to get to it, but the imagery and stuff is sculpted and kind of the layout of it really kind of guides you into where he's got a really beautiful sense of design as well as, let's say, the technique that he does. They often like the extra texture, the extra kind of feeling that he gets out. Because in a lot of cases, there'll be almost like a pen and ink drawing at the heart of it.
Yeah.
But then that layering gives it such a different flavor. Almost like, you know, what it reminds me of, you know, when you see like in the middle of a city and there's a board that's had 100 posters on it and then some of them have been ripped off.
Yeah.
And then the layering of all those little pieces put together, that it's that kind of feeling and that kind of layering that I think you see a lot in his work, although his is a lot cleaner than that.
Yeah,
there's no mess in what he does. No,
definitely not. And it all every element in his creation has a purpose there.
Yeah,
and you might not see that purpose the first time you look at it, but you can keep coming back to it.
Yeah,
he also managed to create it. He also has created some books. At least somebody else told him, like, your work would be perfect for a book.
Yeah.
And probably his first reaction would be like, are you sure?
Yeah.
Nobody would buy that. I think he made like 3 or 4 books already. And those are the books that you like to have on your coffee table books.
Yeah.
And to pick it up, look through it, and you're like, what? I didn't see that before. Or I didn't see that before. And it's so fun to see that. And there is a purpose for his art. And there's also a purpose. There's also a reason sometimes his work doesn't work. Or makes it very confusing for people. And there's 2 things that spring to mind. One was a poster that he did for a show at Barnbos. Which was so incredibly cool. It was an image of this Michelin guy, Michelin, like the famous Michelin doll.
The tire guy.
Yeah. And then he used that and made morphing things around it and patterns that were like fun, very, very weird. And people were looking at those posters and they were like, okay, I have a couple of questions. Who is playing? Where is it? And how much does it cost? And you're like, yeah, but this is one name, this is one name, this is one name. Here, the venue name is here in this round circle that has all this funky stuff around it. And the price, the price is over here. Look. And people are like, no, I don't get it. And I think also one of the probably the most beautiful one I saw was the one that he did for Peel Slowly. He actually did the Peel Slowly poster. And when I saw the first thing, I was like, okay, this is going to be, this is going to cause some confusion in our own group.
Yeah.
Because I have some people in the Peel Slowly group that are very like, okay, we need to, are direct, like, okay, can I see everything I need to see? And when I showed them the first design of the poster, they were like, what? What is this? And like, this is Spiel Slowly. You need to figure out what it's all about. Yeah. And they were like, no. No, people will not understand. And why is it blue and pink together? Like, why not?
Yeah.
And seeing those posters in the city on those boards where you can put it up, and it's like, wow, this is so cool.
Yeah.
All right. People didn't get it. People find it very confusing.
Yeah. We are going to have to share links and...
Oh, definitely.
And stuff on it. Especially when we're talking about visual artists, like, we're quite good at saying, oh yeah, this is really good, and then not giving anybody a link to anything. So
we will definitely add some visual links to this.
But you know him very well. I mean, I know of him quite for a very long time. I've met him two or three times.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, but only briefly.
Yeah.
But you know him as everyone talks about him in a kind of similar manner, that he's quite, yeah, I don't really, yeah. Like, he's not really interested. Is he quite aloof as a person, or is he?
He is like a proper artist.
Mm.
He's like, doesn't really want to be the one that is getting all the attention, but he wants to make stuff.
Yeah.
I think if he doesn't have to talk to people, he would be very happy. And he will talk to his friends and his girlfriend and everybody that he's let into his circle, but he doesn't want to be the center of the attention.
Hmm.
He wants his work to be the attention.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. He's also been in a band.
Yeah.
He's been in the Richard Foster band. We sort of forced him for Richard to be on stage.
Yeah.
And
I've been around him, but I don't know him very well.
He's been in the Richard Foster kids. And he's also released some stuff on Smikkelbart as well. And on Smikkelbart we did a release. It's called Sinterbart and Smikkelpiet. And he actually did the cover for that. And it's one of those images that follows the pattern that if you put it next to each other, it continues. And he did that a couple of times during that period. And some of those are really, really funny and really nice. And it's just, it's also a nice dude.
Yeah.
He's, there was also this story with him that he did he got in touch with a gallery that wanted to promote his work. So they created this expo with his work, and he put it on the wall, and they were like, Victor, how much money do you want for this thing? And he was like, yeah, 20. And like, what, 20? No, 100. Like, no, nobody will buy it. Let's first put it up there and see how it works. And during that exposition, I think he sold like 80% of his work. And he was like, why? Why do people pay so much money for this? And price-wise, he's probably the worst person ever.
Yeah. He's not a businessman.
He's not a businessman at all. I think he has realized that his work is... He's able to ask money for it. And he can able to ask a good amount of money for it because it's worth it, but he finds it super difficult. But it's also nice to have somebody around that you know you can just say, like, could you do this for me, and it has to be this, and he's like, okay, I'll do whatever I feel like is fit within those parameters. And it's a nice guy.
And what's your favorite memory of him?
Of him?
Yeah.
I think one of the favorites, the most funniest thing was we did a festival called Cultuur Barbaar.
Mm-hmm.
And during that event, it was a combination of University Leiden and Richard and myself from the Smikkelbart part collaborating. One of the performances was Jaco. I bet we probably talked about Jaco before.
I'm not entirely sure we have.
Okay.
Maybe briefly, but yeah. For those that maybe just listen to this one, a brief description of Jaco might be worth.
Big guy, hairy chest, wants to scare you.
Very apt description, I think.
Wow. And on that moment, Jaco and Victor met each other for the first time. And it was worlds colliding.
Yeah.
Because Jaco is more a performer, but also an artist.
Yeah.
And he's the complete opposite. He's like, it's me.
Yeah.
See me, I'm here.
He's the big extrovert.
Yeah. Where's the spotlight? Yeah. I'll push you away. And while Jaco was performing, Victor was handed a piece of paper and started doodling on it and made a really, real cool piece instantly there. On that place while Jaco was doing a performance, I was like, this is so cool to have like so different kind of way of expressing yourself, but also making both making art in the same space.
Yeah.
And that was so nice.
Cool. Well, I'm in a very similar vein as a very dear friend of mine. He grew up in the same village as me.
Mm-hmm.
His name's Andrew L. Pachoric, Andy Pachoric, or Little Andy, as we call him. He probably hates that I call him Little Andy, but I'd never called him that. But when it was Andy's the reason that I ended up on the Travel and Fun Fair for 6 months in the Middle East.
Okay.
He'd already worked on it. And everyone on the fair called him Little Andy. And it just stuck. So he's been stuck with it since. But he probably hates it. So if you listen, Andy, I'm sorry, but you're still Little Andy. But obviously I knew him. He's about 4 or 5 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a really interesting family history too. So his father's Polish and had been in a couple of, I think, two different concentration camps and then was basically rescued in some sense and taken to England, and he lived on a POW camp in the northeast of England, bizarrely. And that's where he met his wife, who's Italian. So Andy's parents are Polish and Italian, and they met in I think they met at that prisoner of war camp and then settled in the area. So they settled in Howden Le Wier.
Okay.
And they had three kids, and Andy's the youngest of the three. And when I was a kid, so between the streets that I lived on and Andrew's house, there was what we called the Battery. And that's literally like just a piece of open land that everyone used to play on. And they built a big playground on it and a football ground and this, that, and the other. But when we were young kids, it was just the Battery, and there was the top Battery and the bottom. And that's where the railway line used to run through the village.
Okay.
Obviously the railway has been gone for quite some years by the time we were around, but that strip of land and some of the sleepers were still there. And like, it was just like kind of left. That we used to cross the Battery, play on the Battery, blah, blah, blah. And Andy's house was basically just off the Battery in the backyard. But the reason we started going to his house was like in his shed. He was a big comic collector. So we used to go and read comics in like from him. And we're talking like a shed full of comics. So whether it's Beano 2000 AD, lots of like the kind of UK comics, Andy had hundreds and hundreds of them. So it was brilliant. When I was a kid, it was like, oh, I've got Andy's and just sit and read his comics. And then I kind of gave up. So I'd known him all my life. And obviously with him being about, I think he's like 4 or 5 years old, right? He went away to university before I did. Mm-hmm. And then when I'd gone away to university and came back, he was back living in Howden. Now, Andy'd done like art college at sixth form. He'd gone to Wolverhampton, I think.
down near Birmingham, and I think he'd studied art or something down there. And anyway, he was back at home, and I came back, and I'd just finished university, and then I'd spent the year running the student union, and then I was moving back, and I was thinking of moving up to Newcastle. And I just turned 21, and I got this insurance policy through, and I used that insurance policy to go to America for 6 weeks.
Okay.
And we were out drinking one night on a Friday night, and I went, "Why don't you come?" And he went, "Okay." So the two of us ended up traveling together. And which was weird, because we'd known each other for years, but never like, and then in that last year or two, whenever I was at home, we would go and maybe have a drink or like, so we'd kind of got to know each other a bit, or kind of a bit more than we had, kind of in depth, so to speak.
Yeah.
But then we went traveling for 6 weeks, and that was like, also the two of us were like, "Is this really like, are we going to get on? Is this going to work?" Like, well, what we found is we actually settled into like really well together.
Okay.
So at that point, Andy had, he'd moved away from university. He'd then ended up in North Wales, where he was working at Butlins. And again, doing like sideshow stall things at Butlins. Mm-hmm. He'd apparently lived in a flat with his girlfriend, but they didn't have that very much money. So they basically erected a tent in the living room because they couldn't afford to heat the apartment.
Yeah.
And then lived in the tent.
Okay.
And then he'd got the guy who'd, like, it was a Welsh fun fair from Porthcawl, and the guy who ran that had gone round the button and said, "Hey, you seem to be good at these games. Do you want to come work for me?" And then through that, Andy had got to work in the Philippines and in the Middle East, back to the Philippines, and then they were going to the Middle East again.
Yeah.
So when we'd done our trip to the US, and there's a lot of stories to talk about in there, when we came back and I was at Newcastle, I'd said, "Oh, if you ever get the chance to go out again, give me a call." So he's the one who called me up kind of towards the end of that year and said, "Oh, we're going to the Middle East again. Do you want to go?" So it's for him that I ended up kind of, as my parents say, run away and join the circus. But that's how I ended up in the Middle East.
Yeah, because before that, you didn't really have much circus experience.
No, apart from I had gone to the circus once as a kid.
Yeah.
Was dragged up out of the crowd, made to stand on a horse with a rope around me and try and stand up as this horse went round the thing. And then, of course, I fell off the horse and they just had me swinging through the air for a while. But that's where I became terrified of clowns, because the clowns were these really angry old short men with happy faces on that just growled and shouted at me, and I was like, "I don't trust you at all." And since that day, I'm completely like,
okay,
"Oh, I don't feel good around clowns." Although, quick clown aside, my favorite clown story, when we were in Oman on the fair, so we were stationed in this just bit of waste ground in the middle of nowhere, but they put this big event on, and at the end of the fairground, there was an Italian circus. So it was all part of this big thing. And Sultan Qaboos, the leader of Oman, had come round, and he was throwing silk scarves to everybody. And he was like, I mean, he's a tiny man, absolutely tiny man. But he came and he played me game and blah, 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 watched that. And then while we were setting up in this weird thing, we were all having a break, and we all went to what we call like the top of the ground. And we were looking out and just having a laugh and having a can of pop or whatever. And there's about five or six of us talking, and the circus was exercising all the animals. So they had a couple of, had some horses, they had a couple of camels, they had a tiger, which was really impressive.
Yeah.
And oh, so I'm getting ahead of myself. But they had like this sheepdog type dog that was obviously like part of the group. And there was a clown who again was let's say he was, I'm not sure what's the right word now, but he was a vertically challenged man. He was a dwarf clown.
Yeah.
Right. But he was dressed in like proper kind of flashy pin, like stripy suit like big blazer jacket. Mm-hmm. They'd almost put him in like, you know, those trousers that kind of make you look fatter than you are.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was in like jokey clothing. So he looked like this round person,
yep.
but with a massive hat, like a big wide brim hat, but like the mid, like the hat was almost as tall as him.
Okay.
Okay. So he looked like, have you seen Nightmare Before Christmas?
I think, yeah.
The animation, you know, yeah, the mayor.
Yeah. Yeah.
He looked like the mayor, but with color. Right?
Okay, okay.
So there's this short man dressed in all this gear. And the dog had obviously took a fancy to him, right? Well, his dog was huge. The dog, when it was on its hind legs, was about the same height as this fella, right? But the dog obviously thought, oh, I like the look of that. So the dog jumped on his back and Aww. Tried to hump him, right? Aww. At which point, like, everyone who's, like, walking the horses and stuff like that starts giggling. And this, first of all, the hat comes off. And then this guy starts screaming and shouting. And he turns around. He's trying to push this dog off, right? And then the dog's getting really riled up. The dog keeps jumping up at him to the point that the fella lost his hat. And it broke into a proper fight. So this fella's just punching this dog in the face. Like trying to get the dog's then getting angry. The dog's jumping up and attacking him. The two of them are rolling around on the floor like this dog's trying to eat him alive. This guy's trying to push him. And everybody was just in hysterics, like in absolute hysterics. No one could help him because everyone was like, follow. At which point one of the horses was let go because the guy couldn't hold on to the reins anymore. It was absolute chaos. But there was like a proper 5-minute fight
yeah.
between this clown and a dog.
Wow.
it was quite ridiculous. But back to Andy.
Yeah.
Andy had, like I say, he'd studied art at this, that, and the other. We'd traveled together.
Mm-hmm.
But he'd, I think when he was at Wolverhampton, when he first got back to the thing, he'd entered a competition for a program on Channel 4 in the UK.
Yeah.
And he'd ended up with this comic strip that they'd made a couple of videos of it called Outer Space Babe.
Okay.
And it was this black and white pen and ink drawn stuff. And his artwork's always been really interesting, really fun, but very like comic influenced.
Yeah.
But he does a lot in pen and ink. He started to change it, but it's mainly like black and white pen and ink drawings. And then he'd started doing bits of illustration for people. Over time, he's now, I would say, one of the leading illustrators for macabre fantasy, kind of folk horror, like otherworldly kind of stuff. And he's built up this gargantuan portfolio of imagery, which is, in some cases, quite disturbing.
Yeah.
But really fascinating, and it's very, like I say, the majority of it is pen and ink.
Yeah.
So it's just like kind of graphic pen work, really detailed. And the fact that most of it is black, with and it's more like he's someone who is, his style almost doesn't have a line to it. He's got a really really deep, fascinating kind of copy, but because it's all the detail he can get out of just leaving little shapes in black is quite impressive. But he started through conversations that we'd had about like films that we liked, and we would talk about folk horror films that we liked, and we'd say, oh, I wonder if there should be more folk horror. This has gone back probably nearly 10 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So he started up a Facebook page called Folk Horror Revival.
Okay.
And just started sharing stuff about, and there was like the three main folk horror films for the UK is Blood on Satan's Claw, The Wicker Man, and others of Witchfinder General's the third.
Yeah.
And starts sharing about stuff like that. And then very quickly that grew to be a group of like a few thousand members. And he kind of moderated that for a long time. He was then invited to speak on folk horror at a range of places, including, let's say, like different universities and the BF, I think the London Museum and British Museum, stuff like that. So he's become a kind of vocal authority on that subject. Over time, he's now got to the point that he's kind of had enough of that and he's delving into other areas of like hauntology and this, that, and the other. Really interesting. But like when Andy goes into something, he goes so deep yeah. that it's quite, but he does a lot of illustrative work for like wildlife stuff. Mm-hmm. So he spent a lot of time like volunteering for kind of wildlife charities and nature reserves and things like that. So he's always been really busy, and yet he's never really had what you would call like a normal job, but he's kept him, he's sustained himself by writing, by illustrating, by doing this thing. And now he's a full-time carer for his dad.
Okay.
So his mom passed a few years ago now, and she was the most amazing woman. But he's now looking after his dad. His dad's in his late 90s still, and there's no sign of going anywhere. But Andy's like such a fascinating guy, because to the people in the village, he's just little Andy, and he does, what's he do? He's stuff about, he's always about saving the butterflies and stuff. And like, he's a part of protesting about getting rid of the allotments and blah, blah, blah. So like, they know little bits about him.
Yeah, yeah.
But nobody has any idea that this lad who lives and looks after his dad has written like 5 books, has illustrated like hundreds and hundreds of like really impressive stuff. He's like this hidden little talent that yeah. the entire village has no idea of. He's just Yolanda and Michael's kid, and he's kind of hidden away in that. But he's a fascinating guy. He's really fun. He's really passionate and deeply fierce. Like if he's into something, he's like full on. Mm-hmm. And he's like, if, and his politics are really strong, and he, like I say, he's got a real fierce passion in him, which I think he gets from his mother. His mother was brilliant, Yolanda, but she used to hit me all the time. She said, "Well, you're a bugger, yeah," and poof, like that. "What was that for?" "Well, you probably did something." I was like, "Okay," but she was lovely. She was like, "Oh, she was a lovely woman." But Andy and like we've done bits and pieces together. So like just when I first moved to Holland and was bored, I would write like a little poem about some unfortunate kid,
yeah.
send it to him, and then suddenly I'd get a book back that would be like all illustrated. So we did this series of like kind of comic book stuff with us, more as a kind of pen pal thing.
Okay, okay.
Of this collection called Howden's Children that we've talked about kind of publishing a number of times, never got around to doing anything with it, but they're all quite fun. And that came from a shared love. Like when we were traveling together, I introduced him to Tim Burton's book of like melancholy children and like these little illustrations and poems that he wrote. Yeah. And we both had it. So I started trying to write my own version of that. But then we've built that up into like a range of stuff. And then from that, like I say, the amount of work that he's got is quite extraordinary now. So he's behind a thing called Weird Harvest Press, which is WYRD.
Okay.
Harvest Press. And they published a range of books on folk horror, on urban weird, but like real like big collations of essays and public, like really, like I say, when he goes deep, he goes really deep. Mm-hmm. And they're fascinating stuff. But he's also doing a lot of like comic strip books with people and like random he did a lot of illustrations for a thing called Cumbrian Cthulhu, which is basically a set of people in the UK that are writing Cthulhu influenced tales, but set in Cumbria in the Northwest. So like the Lake District is full of Shoggoths and weird creatures and stuff like that. If you start to investigate the type of stuff, there's it's like, you know, when you've someone introduces you to a musical artist and suddenly you find that there's like a whole back catalogue of like 15, 20. I'm like, "Oh gosh, I can dive in."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Andy's like that. Because you go, "Oh, what's he doing? Does that thing?" And then suddenly there's this wealth of stuff in there.
Yeah.
And I think I own about 6 or 7 different pieces or books and stuff that he's got. And I can't keep up with him. He's so prolific. He's so talented. And yet my memories of him are usually tied up around us either having bizarre adventures in the US or the Middle East or
laughing or about like a that. Guy yeah. being attacked by a dog.
Yes, but I don't think he was there that day.
Oh, okay.
When we were in the States together, like every day, and we spent 6 weeks there, mm-hmm. and I think we spent like 2 nights on accommodation. So the rest of it, people just put us up, or we slept on the Greyhound. Yeah. So we had like a Greyhound pass, and like the only people that take a Greyhound in the US are either they've just got out of prison, they've been given a ticket to get home,
yeah,
or they're people that don't drive, mm-hmm. which is a very, very small amount of people in the US. Yeah. Or there's something wrong with them. Mentally, they're the only three groups that travel on the Greyhound.
Yeah,
and then there's us, two bright pink lobster boys.
Hello,
hello. And like I said, I was 21. He'll have been like 25, I think. And every day was just like I've always had a bit of a freak magnet.
Yeah,
but Andy's got one too. So they put the two of us together. We just met every lunatic.
Wow.
In the northeast of America. And okay. It was every day was like three or four random lunatics. And especially when you start your day in a Greyhound bus station, yeah. something's going to happen. And then when it gets to the end of the night and you're like, oh, should we stay here? Should we have we'll just have a beer somewhere close to the bus station. Random stuff will happen. And there's hundreds and hundreds of random bizarre people that we met on that trip.
But do you consider Andy like also to be the introvert artist that doesn't really want to be in the spotlight? Because it sounds like
I think he's too busy to be in the spotlight.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I think Andy's well known in his circle,
mm-hmm.
but because his full time job essentially is looking after his dad.
Yeah.
He's got no time to go out. Occasionally he'll like go and do a talk somewhere or go and do this. And he's very active. His work is run from the house.
Yeah.
So he spends a lot of his time online. He does. I mean, he's well connected, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
He's so prolific, so prolific.
Mm-hmm.
But Andy doesn't have any, I don't know if he's got any inclination to want to go down that light. Again, he's well respected. He's well known in those fields that he's into.
Yeah.
But he's certainly not someone who chases the limelight, but his focus is on making sure his dad's okay.
Yeah.
So he's got a real wonderful kind of dual existence. And I'm not sure he would call it wonderful. I think he feel like he's trapped in the village that he doesn't want to be part of.
Yeah.
But and his sister's dog, I've just remembered, was called Ronnie Barker, right? Which is the name of an old comedian in the UK. So it always tickled me, and like whenever people have dog names, I think it's going to be hard to beat Ronnie Barker for a dog. But they're a great family. They're really close. Mm-hmm. They're really good friends of mine. And again, his mother was an angel. I loved her. Yeah. Even if she battered me. She once battered me. She broke a wrist and she had a pot on her hand and she loved it because then she could hit me with something. And she always treated me like I was in trouble. And then she's like, well, you've probably done something. But she was great.
Aww.
But Andy's one of the most fascinating people I've ever come across. And I was just so lucky to have grown up pretty much across the street from him.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, he always seemed quite cool because he had long hair. He was into more kind of weird music.
Yeah.
But I knew him first. He had loads of comics. That was interesting too. He liked drawing. He was a great artist. That was interesting to me. When I got older and we started getting up, we liked a lot of the same music. We kind of had like some thing. And then in doing bits and pieces with him, he's a real creative force that would kind of get some stuff out of me as well, mm-hmm. as him. But just watching where he's gone to is totally like, I mean, almost in awe of what the amount of stuff he's been able to churn out.
Yeah.
But he's got some really cool books on. So when we were in
Cincinnati. The reason we went to Cincinnati for the day was because we'd seen an advert that there'd been an exhibition on in that town of old Carney posters.
Okay.
So the old like American Carney posters. Now we weren't sure if the exhibition was still on, but the decision was if Cincinnati is the type of town that would have an exhibition like that, we need to go to it. And every we spent the whole day, people going, "What the hell are you here for?" Which was usually like same thing in Pittsburgh, Indianapolis. Yeah. No one comes here. Well, we heard this thing was on. So we went to the museum where that thing was. And of course, it wasn't there anymore. But since then, Andy's written his own book. I think it's called The Human Chimera. I think it's the right title. And it's he's done a study of loads of the performers who were in those old Carney days. And then it's like his illustrations of those people with a quick story about each of them. And what so he's like, again, when he goes, gets into something, he dives deep.
Yeah.
So he's not just looked up these things, read stuff. He's then researched them all, turned that into a book about that thing. And then he goes off and he's done something else. And he's got books on Slavic folklore. He's got books on UK folklore. Like, honestly, there's a treasure trove of stuff to go in there. And he also did some drawings that we used on Incendiary for a bit too. So his stuff's kind of everywhere. But from the little comic stuff that he started with to the level of stuff that he's doing now is quite... It's a really fascinating journey to see how his art has developed.
Yeah.
I think he's easily one of my favorite graphic illustrators. And also because I like the kind of weird and the macabre and the stuff like that, his stuff really suits me. But I mean, his stuff is really grisly. It's great. it's like when he was a kid, it used to be like horror comics and they would have like drawings of like skulls with like bits of skin hanging off, stuff like that.
You can
tell that Andy devoured all of that as a kid.
Yeah.
And like Hammer horror films and stuff like that. It's really at the heart of a lot of what he does, but his work is fascinating. And he's such a cool lad anyway. He's one of my favorite people. And yeah, you just Andy Paciorek, Paciorek.
Yeah.
Bit of a mouthful to pretend, but he's a bit like Victor. Once you start looking, it's like, wow, like what is this? And yet to the people in the village, he's like, is he still trying to say butterflies or something? Like they have no idea who he is or what he's doing.
But is there one thing that he inspired you?
He's the one who just from conversations with it, he started me writing poetry.
Okay.
I'd apart from the like odd exercises at school, I'd written a lot of short stories, a lot of longer form, like screen plays and stuff like that. But when we were in the Middle East, on the fair, well, we talked about a lot in the US first, and we talked a lot about poetry and I'd never done it. And then when we were in the Middle East, it was such an intense period.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a really, we had a lot of fun, but it was a lot of hard work. And it was like really, I've never been in anything as intense as that period. And my brain literally couldn't cope with it for a while. And in the middle of that, there was, let's say like, just like some kind of weird relationship that wasn't going anywhere. And like, it wasn't really a relationship, but I wanted it to be. And then that person, it was all like really heady. And everyone were like, there was eight of us trapped in this 2-bedroom apartment and like living on top of each other, working 12 hours a day, then partying till 5, then getting up and doing it again and again. And one night I just kind of fell out of me like the first poem, and I just wrote something and went to bed. And when I woke up, Mandy was like, what the hell is this? This is like, okay, it sounds like you're having trouble, but this is really good. And then we started doing exercises with each other where, like just to pass time on a night, we'd sit down and it was like, I'll describe something to you and then you draw it.
Yeah.
And then you do the same to me. So like he would just say, oh, like there's three men on surfboards going down a river with crocodiles jumping out of them. And then you have to draw that in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then we would do like silly little stuff back and forth. But that really started a kind of surge of like stuff out of me, just to like, oh, I like to deal with the in,
intensity of what we were doing, we started just doing these weird little essays. And then from that, this like reams and reams of poetry and stuff, most of it unreadable, but like it kind of came out. And then when we came back and I came to Holland, that's when we kind of continued that. And that's where the whole Howden's Children stuff came off. I'll bring some down for you to look at, because as much as they're just something we did on the off chance, they're actually really fun. And there's one called Poor Jim Rottenshaw. And it's basically that this weird, I don't know where it came from. I don't know where most of my stuff comes from, but there's this boy who ends up with a tapeworm, but the tapeworm eats him alive. And it like eats his eyes out and eats it, just completely eats him to think. So this really happy, jolly sounding poem is basically this boy being eaten alive. And then at the end, but Andy's illustrated it and it looks like the cutest kids book type thing. And it's really dark and really horrible.
Wow.
But it's quite fun. And then sometimes they're just like, yeah, just fun little stuff about kids. But I've then built up a library of stuff around that, a lot of which has never kind of seen the light of day, but just done for fun.
Yeah.
And then Andy and I have always talked about, yeah, we should do this with her, but he's so busy and we've never kind of, that kind of has gone to the wayside and he's just gone and done his own thing. But like I say, he's so prolific and so busy, I'm not sure our stuff would ever get back to being anything. Yeah. But it really helped both of us at the time to keep doing something. And then I was doing that at the time that we were starting Incendiary.
Okay.
So it was really like getting a lot of stuff out of my system, getting a little bit of practice and stuff for him. Mm-hmm. But where he's taken it is like, he's a bit like Richard. Is like, he's one of those people who's like, I've done a little bit, but then when you see where that kind of is, like, wow, there's something else going on there.
Yeah.
Like my directions are a bit more impulsive and going all over the place, but there's a drive to both of them that is really interesting to follow.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two good people there.
Yeah. And we managed to almost reach an hour. So I think
Okay. There's a lot more to share on especially for that trip in the US, but we'll save that for another day, I think. And Victor, there's loads. I mean,
oh, there's so much more.
Yeah.
I think also Richard has good stories about him.
Yes.
And I think we should come back to some other people. I think we should definitely come back to Jaco again.
Oh, yes. We might have to prepare people for that one. But he's such you kind of say stuff like that about Jaco as fun, but he's so much fun.
He's
so intense.
I know people that are scared of him.
Yeah, but I think he's...
And I was like, and then I talked to him like, why?
Yeah.
Because he's super nice.
Yeah, he's like, he's really gentle in himself.
Yeah, yeah.
But when he's on, he's on.
Yeah, yeah. If he's on or near a stage...
Yeah,
I understand that he might come off as a scary dude.
Yeah, but anyway, we'll talk about him on another day.
Yeah, we should.
Thank you, dear earlobes, for putting up with us again this far. Yes. We hope to speak to you again soon.
Yes, on a more regular base.
We'll try.
We'll try.